My castaway this week is a playwright. His father was a policeman who became a Methodist minister, but he went straight into the theatre after leaving Cambridge. His work is epic and controversial. One of his early plays, Brass Neck, was a collaboration with David Hare about corruption in local politics. In Magnificence, he criticised Tory high politics. The Romans in Britain caused Mary Whitehouse to prosecute for procuring the cast to commit immoral acts. And another play of his, A Short, Sharp Shock, had the Minister for the Arts, Norman St. John Stevens, apologising to the House of Commons because a state-subsidised theatre had put it on. The author of all of this, nevertheless, believes that theatre should be fun. I'm a playwright and a showman, he says, and I think in images that are never quite rational. He is Howard Brenton. So theatre is primarily an entertainment, is it, Howard, not a soapbox?
Oh, yes, it's an entertainment. I think it's a kind of exorcism. We are trying to get rid of demons. I mean, the Greeks believed it was part of public health.
But you said, in the early days when you were just making your reputation, you said, I would very much like to change the world with my plays. How disappointed are you that you haven't done that, or perhaps you think you have?
Hugely disappointed. I think you should
have
a smile.
Yes.
I think you should have massive ambitions as a playwright or in any walk of life. I don't see the point of doing it if you don't.
But are you saying, nevertheless, admitting that you haven't changed the world?
Oh, yes, quite obviously, yes. I think the world's gone backwards since I began writing. In fact, I think my generation has not succeeded in a number of its projects. So I expected Britain to be a better country now when I started writing 30 years ago.
So, despite the smile, there is great disappointment, is there?
Yes.
Failure?
Yes, but determination perhaps in your old age, you may enter a later period in which you may actually write something which does have some good effect.
And indeed you're writing something about Tony Blair as we speak, aren't you?
I've just finished with Tariq Ali, a satire on the government, with which we hope to have some good fun in a few months' time in the West End.
And it's called The Resistible Rise of Antonio B?
Well, at the moment it's called Ugly Rumours.
Which was his rock band, isn't it?
Which was, yes, the Prime Minister's rock band. But titles change.
But in all of this, it's interesting, watching you in that early television performance I was saying, where you said, I'd very much like to change the world. There was a kind of genial missionary zeal about it all, and one can still hear it a bit now. And is it any coincidence that your father was a Methodist minister? I mean, is there something of the preacher in you, do you think?
Oh, you can't get rid of it. You can't get rid of Methodism like you can't get rid of Catholicism. Nor really do I want to, because there's something kindly and clear and good-hearted about Methodism. You're taught to speak from the heart, and although this may be a disgusting habit, it never leaves you.
But you didn't end up in the pulpit. You ended up on the stage, or behind it anyway, as we shall hear. Tell me about your first record.
Glenn Gould playing a Bach fugue. I've always loved Bach. The very first record I had was of a Brandenburg concerto, and this is Fire and Ice.
Glenn Gould playing part of Bach's Fugue in C minor from his Well-Tempered Clavier. And you were just observing that that's the only one of your eight records without the human voice on it. Not even Glenn Gould's, I think.
Glenn Gould was famous for singing while he played, and the Sony engineers have a life project to remove this from the recordings, I think.
But you've chosen them musically, not because of any memory in your life.
I love playing music, and it was wonderful torment to have to choose these records.
And you're a bit of an anorak about it all, I understand.
Yes, I was in a big London record shop and I suddenly realised we were all blokes poring over these records. A bit like train spotters saying, have you got the curry on? And carry on is called the Nazi amongst my fraternity. And they say, you have to whisper, do you go Nazi on Bruckner?
Let's talk about the Romans in Britain, because it was, you know, the most controversial moment of your career, if you like. 1980, 81, something like that?
80.
The National, a play which was at first about Julius Caesar et al. And then became about British troops in Northern Ireland and so on. It was profoundly shocking. It was meant to be. What was the scene that upset Mary Whitehouse so much?
The scene was a male rape scene between Roman soldiers and young native British Celts. And what was really shocking about the scene was that the Roman soldiers tell jokes and the audience enjoy the squatty jokes at first. And then you realise what you've been sucked into. The Romans simply don't see them. They're hardly objects. The young men are between them and a swim in a river on a rather bad day during a rather minor exercise of war. I had the My Lai massacre in mind in Vietnam.
So it was just another day, just somebody else to kill while you got on with getting to where it was you wanted to get.
Yes, I tried to dramatise how casual cruelty is and how the people who do it don't realise their own obscenity.
But, of course, it was Michael Bogdanoff, the director, who was prosecuted directly, wasn't it, by Mary Whitehouse for procuring
these
names.
Well, this was a horrible thing. I'd have stood up and defended it in court.
Had you actually written it in the script?
Yes. Oh, yes. You can buy the script. It's still published. And you can see what the controversial scene is. But the nasty thing about it was that Michael was hit. They couldn't get at me because of they'd trawled through the laws of old England to try and get us. And the only way they could get at us was to prosecute the director, as if he was a pimp, for a law which was to do with pimping.
But what happened in the end to that prosecution? I can't remember what
it was. Collapsed in farce. The prosecution lawyer went to the judge and said, I do not think I can continue. And if a prosecutor says that to a judge, they have to find a way of stopping the trial.
But the irony is surely that you meant this to be a play, you know, comment, as I said, on the British in Northern Ireland, but in the end it was sex, not politics, that got the watchdogs out of their kennels, wasn't it?
The theatre can get out of hand. People can misunderstand, things can just run away from you.
And you don't mind that. You don't mind that as long as your theatre makes waves. It doesn't matter if they're the wrong waves. Is that what you're saying?
I want the right waves. I want everyone
ideally
bathing on the beach.
Sure.
But if the drownings start happening, they're out of your control.
But how much do you plan for?
You know, it's a democratic thing, the theatre. Audiences make what they will.
Yes, of course. But obviously, as I say, you want strong reactions. But how much do you plan for? Do you think we will have naked people on stage? We will simulate acts of buggery because this will get us a lot of publicity? Cynically, one could say that's what you do.
No, you say this is what happens. I mean, there's a rule with playwriting. You try and see it being done on the stage, and then you imagine what it would be like in real life, and you try and focus the two together. It's an oddly strong visual drive you have
you
to do.
You exaggerate the reality. This is what you mean by irrational images, is it?
Yes, yes. And then you try and stage it truthfully, using stagecraft. And stagecraft is often an exaggerated thing. But your aim is to be true to what would happen. And I suspect these incidents happened somewhere up in the woods around Tring on 54 BC.
Record number two.
This is Monteverdi. This is the coronation of Poppea. Monteverdi's songs are very passionate and theatrical. And this is a wonderful example, Poppea trying to seduce Nero, of all people.
Signor de non partire, sostien che queste braccia ti circondino il collo.
Sylvia McNair as Poppea and Donna Hanchard as Nerone, singing their duet Signor de non partire from Act One of Monteverdi's L'Incoronazione di Poppea, with the English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. So straight out of Cambridge, Howard Brenton, and into the theatre, but as an assistant stage manager, 1965, Worthing rep, Chelmsford rep?
That's right.
Well, what kinds of plays? Alan Ayckbourne as now, I suppose?
No, they weren't. Alan Ayckbourne is like Aeschylus compared to the plays we were doing. They were thrillers and comedies. The thrillers usually with the murderer revealed in the last line before the curtain. And I used to do walk-on parts.
What kind of walk-on parts did you have?
I remember once having to put on a fisherman's sou'wester and walk on to the stage with a large papier-mâché salmon and say the line, "The old grey lady is dead," at which the curtain fell and the audience applauded. And I never understood why, because as an ASM, you were concerned with moving props around on the stage, so it was bizarre. The play seemed bizarre. You had to move phial of poison from desk to under sofa at the end of Act Two. Act Three, put phial of poison in lamp, and you never really knew why.
So did you always do it on cue? I mean, did you always get the curtain coming down? Or...
I once had a bizarre incident when I'd risen to the heights of being a stage manager and I had an ASM. And it was another play with the murderer revealed in the last line. I heard this strange noise coming from the stage about three pages before the end. I went down on the stage and there were actors in a state of shock staring at the curtain. My assistant had brought the curtain down three pages earlier.
What did the audience do?
The audience applauded and left.
And they didn't notice.
Well, they didn't mind. And to this day, the mystery of the theatre is in that story for me, because what were they watching? They weren't waiting to know who the murderer was. They were reading the play in some other way.
But if you believe that, you'd never have written for an audience because they're just utterly undiscerning.
Well, it is. No, they're not. They're thoroughly discerning, but they may be discerning things at you as the playwright, or certainly on that occasion as one of the people putting the show on, don't quite gather. No. I think they were there watching the permanent company, a bit like people support their football team. And if it's a sort of rather goalless draw, as probably the play was, they don't mind. They've seen their boys and girls playing.
Is this a comment on people who go to local rep? You mean they're just faithful and they turn up?
No, I think it's a general thing that you must sort. You really want to make people understand, to be rational, beautiful, strong in what you put on the stage. But you never know how people are reading it.
Record number three.
This is Mahler's The Song of the Earth. In the early days of VHS, of FM radio, I remember taking the family radio into the living room and hearing this for the first time. It blew my mind away.
Fritz Wunderlich singing Das Trinklied von Jammer der Erde from Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, The Song of the Earth, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Otto Klemperer. So from SMing in the home counties, Howard, to being mother-henned at the Royal Court, who mother-henned you and how?
Bill Gaskell, they put on a play just for one night. It went terribly badly. Yes, oh, terribly badly. And Bill Gaskell said, never mind, write us a long play and I'll get you a job meanwhile. And he got me a job in an office through an old press officer of his. And I wrote the play and took it back to them. And I've always been a child of the Royal Court since then. It was my cradle.
Mm.
Although I was a new... This happens in theatre. It happens in the arts. I was a new generation who was knocking on the door to take over the theatre from a previous generation.
Mm. And some huge names in that generation. I mean, David Hare, Trevor Griffiths, Polly Arkoff, Snoo Wilson, so on. And you all collaborated and had a great success at the Fringe, at the Edinburgh Fringe, didn't you?
When we started in the early 70s, yes, we were bored at a theatre conference, which was called What is Theatre? So we decided to go into the bar and start writing a play together. And it turned out to be this curious piece called Lay-By, which went on at the Edinburgh Festival and then came down to London for a bit of a run.
It was very violent, wasn't it?
It was a mixture of just everything you'll pick out of the papers. That was our aim. And we wrote bits of it on crayon on wallpaper. It was a terrific mess and full of energy.
Mm. So how would you define yourself then? If you say you were a new breed, you were coming in off the back of, what, Look Back in Anger, Osborne, Wesker, maybe The Angry Young Men as well, the novelists, yes? So
yes, we were a second wave and we were called the New Jacobeans. Partly because our plays mixed things up. You had comedy and tragedy. You had light and dark. You had different styles within the same plays. And also they tended to be epic, that is, storytelling plays.
But they were about issues. They weren't about life and how she is led. They weren't sort of four actors in a room.
They were issue plays. They became to be called State of the Nation plays, which sounds rather grim, really.
And everything was outdoors, a lot of outdoor action.
That's right. We said, don't set plays in rooms anymore, set them in the open air. Tell stories, tell high and low, like the old Jacobean theatre. Have working class people and aristocrats in the same play.
And have political figures. So instead of
That's
kings,
right.
You'd have MPs.
Yes. Our kings were MPs and businessmen, and our foot soldiers were people out of work, ordinary people.
Mm. And how did that go down then with the established theatre?
Well, we became the establishment. It was so successful.
Well, eventually you did, but at the time, I mean, what did people like Kenneth Tynan think about you, for example?
Well, he was rather disappointed and didn't get the right end of the stick.
But I think Lindsay Anderson as well at the Royal Court at one point
I sat in a room at the Royal Court in the offices, and I heard Lindsay giving forth next door saying, with very, very strong language, this play of mine is never going on in my theatre. This play is expletive deleted. And I thought, oh my God, I suddenly realised he's talking about my play.
And were you pleased?
No, I was horrified. I wanted him to direct it. But the play went on and the generations changed, and now there's a new generation at the Royal Court who is getting rid of us.
Who thinks that you're sort of the boring old orthodoxy.
Absolutely.
And they want to set plays indoors in rooms with four
Absolutely.
Actors.
Absolutely.
It's just a cyclical business. But you were launched, basically, is what we're saying, in the 70s with all of that. You were launched and Peter Hall then arrived at the National, and the first new play he commissioned was from you.
Yes.
Tell me about your next record.
The next record is from The Marriage of Figaro. Peter Hall told me to listen to Mozart's operas. He said, next to Shakespeare, Mozart was the great dramatist of the European stage. And this is a recitative before a more famous aria, but you can hear the brilliant phrasing and dramatization. It's like a great soliloquy.
Say goodbye!
Kirita Kanua as the Countess Almaviva, singing her recitative E Susanna non vien from Act III of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. During the Thatcher years, you were, Howard Brenton, in your own words, more out of fashion than halitosis. They were very long years for people of your political views. On the other hand, I would have thought good years, you know, plenty to kick against.
Yes, looking back, we did do very well. There were some wonderful plays written. Carol Churchill put her finger on the age with her play Top Girls. And the play is now a classic. Mm. So the work was done. Though it was a very strange era. I remember putting on a play at the Court in 87, the height of yuppie paradise, when the play was a socialist utopia. A more unlikely play to succeed,
but
hard to find.
The message, it seemed to me, that you'd been putting forward before that, during the course of the 70s, was that you can only change things through a kind of remorseless grind of political activity. I mean, that was very much what you'd been saying. In a sense, this was a true test of your theory, wasn't it?
Well, with what plays can do is just raise banners, add a few songs, maybe create a line. I always think it's rather like living in a tenement, and there's this room called the theatre. It's a rather small room, and you can all go in there and bang on the pipes, and maybe you'll be heard in rooms elsewhere in the tenement.
That sounds very limiting, really. I mean, why do you go on if you're only going to hope to be heard by the people upstairs in the tenement block?
You hope to make it's a pinprick. The theatre can be a pinprick on the movement of history. You can't expect a play to bring a government down, but it can be part of a movement. It can provide a few songs and scenes and stories.
So the politics is really just a vehicle, is it, for doing what you wanted to do, which was to make theatre?
Well, the two are the same. I'm a theatre man, and that's how I see the world.
It makes you sound less serious about your theatre than one believes you to be, though. That somehow one has the impression that you set yourself up as one of, in the great tradition of literary resistors, as it were.
Well, Brecht said something very interesting once. He said, "I just cannot take myself seriously." Someone like Hauptmann, who was a really serious art expressionist writer, he said, "Hauptmann takes himself seriously. I don't think I can ever achieve that."
But I think
you need a sense of irony when you work in the arts, or else you begin to take yourself too seriously and you turn into the latter-day Tolstoy or go balmy like Shaw did and believe your press releases more than the stories that you're trying to tell.
Record number 5.
I'm a child of the 60s, and this is Bob Dylan. It's not a protest song by him, but it's him at his storytelling best.
Your breath is sweet, with your eyes are like two jewels in the sky. Your back is straight, your hair is smooth on the pillow where you lie. One more cup of coffee before I go to the valley below.
Bob Dylan and One More Cup of Coffee from his album Desire. One of the most interesting things about some of the plays you've written, Howard, is that you collaborate on occasions. I mentioned you've written with David Hare Pravda, very successful example. But Tariq Ali, you collaborated with on Moscow Gold, and there have been others. How do you do it? How does it work? Do you sit down together and...
Comedies are very good to write with someone else because you have to try the jokes out on each other. And you get excited or something dies. You look into someone's eyes while you're telling this line, and if you see coldness, you know it's not working.
It's more likely to make you keep buzzing as well.
That's right,
you
do it quickly. I mean, there have been many of the great TV comedies are written by duos, and there have been great plays in the past. The Front Page was written by two people. And you say, oh, I'd love to see a show in which... Blairism is put on the stage and defined for the first time in the theatre. And you feel, I can't do that on my own. So you hitch up with someone.
But what about something like Pravda with David Hare?
Oh, we rented a flat down in Brighton and went down there separately. He'd drive, I'll go down by train. And we'd be thinking about what we're going to do that day. Meet in this flat, like secret agents, plotting the downfall of Fleet Street.
And how much do you get involved with the production of your plays? You know, do you travel with them in the, you know, provinces? Do you watch the reviews in the audience? I'm sure you watch the reviews, but I mean, do you kind of live and die with them?
It's a long thing, hard learning for playwrights to sit in rehearsals and not panic. Finally, perhaps you begin to learn how to do it. But usually actors want you to be there, and you've got to learn how to talk to actors.
But do directors want you to be there? That's probably
sometimes they want you out because you get too twitchy, and you can't see the wood for the trees, and you say, why isn't it loud enough? Silly things like that.
Mm.
Playwrights always want their plays to be loud. But you begin to learn professionally how to do it.
You went with Moscow Gold, the story of Mikhail Gorbachev, Glasnost, Perestroika and so on. That was the one with the Berlin Wall in it. You went with a pared-down version of that, I think, to Moscow in the winter of 1991, didn't you? Gorbachev still in power. How did that go down with the audience?
It was received ecstatically. And it reminded you what the theatre can really be like. Because they'd never seen in their theatre Gorbachev, Raitzia and Yeltsin walk onto the stage.
They hadn't seen Raitzia and Gorbachev
like
in
that.
Bed together.
They'd never seen a satiric theatre like that. Tarek and I played the other parts and filled in the narrative.
But was it translated?
Translated by an increasingly worried translator, and friends then told us the translation was a bit wonky. But as happens in Moscow, an alarming number of people in the audience understood the English. Mm. We had 800 people packed to the rafters and mafia people selling tickets outside for one performance. And then the world of the play disappeared and it all went.
Next piece of music.
The next piece of music is Shostakovich. For me, the composer of the century, his work so vast, 15 symphonies, 15 string quartets, huge amount of piano music. And he's described an fought inside the century, and I think it'll be some time before we really understand how colossal his music is and how important to us. This is him at his deepest. This is from under the permafrost in Russia, and it's a song for all the lost voices from his 14th symphony.
Evgeny Nesterlienko singing part of O Djelvig Djelvig from Shostakovich's Symphony No. 14 with the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Kondrashin. Of course, there were people in this country, Howard Brenton, who, when you put on Moscow Gold in 1990 at the RSC, thought that it was your big climb down after all that breast beating, that all the, you know, lefty stuff of the 60s and 70s was somehow, you know, wrong, because communism hadn't worked.
We were trying to dramatise the reality of it, in that the Soviet Union's Communist Party was hopelessly corrupt. We thought there were good communists there. They seemed to disappear. It was an agony, really, and an agony of the left, but it has to be faced. We were actually horribly over-optimistic, in that we thought the reform was going to hold and work, and changed the world. Instead, it collapsed into the gangsterism we have now.
Mm. And you go on looking for a middle way. You've always said, you and Tariq Ali have said that you want a middle way between Thatcherism and communism. Well, I mean, there's a lot of ground there.
Well, I don't
think... space.
Yes, I mean, the world we have now, which is like the politics of shopping and little else, is not going to hold for long. It's collapsed in Indonesia. People are going to return to how can we live together justly and share what we have. There's going to be another human attempt at some kind of politics,
but
which
what
is
kind
communistical.
Of politics? So it's communistical. It's old labour, isn't
no,
it?
No, holding things in common. It's rather like the Methodist Church. I mean, it's deep in human history.
More music.
This is from Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony, and it sets Milton to music in the most beautiful way. I love Milton, but I'm not taking him on the island. And this will remind me of Miltonic glories.
Part of the Morning Star from Part 1 of Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony with the Monteverdi Chorus and Orchestra, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. You may be writing less than epic theatre these days, Howard, but if you were sitting on your desert island with a blank sheet of paper, that's what you'd write. You'd write something big, wouldn't you? Something that had huge images in it.
Yes, I think so. Yes,
that's what you really liked, dear.
I'd write... My Times backwards or something.
But lots of devices and props and
a
big cast.
Yes.
And is that what you'll do on your desert island, or do you think you'll give the whole business up, you know, done all that?
I don't know. I'll have to write in my head or perform to myself. Maybe the work will become dangerously psychological if I was alone. I don't think I'll deal with being alone very well, to be honest.
Do you think you'll go under the permafrost?
I think I dangerously could go to pieces, yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Be that bad?
Well, I work in the theatre. I'm a social animal. I like people around me. Theatre's a collaborative art. And suddenly to be alone on this beautiful but probably bug-infested island would give me a lot of personal problems, I think.
But you could create your own utopia, which is what it's all about anyway, isn't it?
Of one, impossible.
Last record.
My last record is from a Bach wedding cantata, simply because it's sexy and beautiful, and I return to Bach because he's my favourite composer.
Lisa Larsen singing part of Weichet nur betrübe Schatten from Bach's wedding cantata with the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Ton Koopman. If you could only take one of the 8 records, Howard, which one would it be?
I'd take the Bach wedding cantata.
That one, the wedding cantata. And what about your book?
Oh, I'd take the Canterbury Tales in the lovely Norton edition, which has the original English and then a cheat down the side in italics telling you what the lines mean.
And why do you want to take that?
Because you wouldn't be able to people your head, at least, if not the island, with wonderful characters.
And what about your luxury?
I thought hard about this. I suppose I should take a pencil and a lot of paper, but I won't. I'll take a bottle of wine, which I will drink a year after being marooned, if I survive. So I'll take a bottle of Chateau Latrousse, the most expensive wine in the world.
Howard Brenton, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.